She's sound asleep. She paused. Are you all right? You sound agitated.
I sat down on the bed, weak with relief. Jack's disappeared, so I thought that maybe you'd phoned with bad news and that he'd gone to talk to you in private, I explained.
What do you mean, disappeared?
Well, he's not in the room. I went into the bathroom to have a bath, and when I came out, he was gone.
He's probably gone down to the reception for something. I'm sure he'll be back in a minute.
How did the wedding go?
Fine. Really well, considering that I couldn't stop thinking about Millie.
I hated that she wasn't there.
She's going to be so disappointed when she realises that we went ahead and got married without her.
Oh, I'm sure she'll understand, Mum soothed. And I felt furious at how little she knew Millie, because of course she wouldn't understand.
I was appalled to find I was near to tears, but after all that had happened, Jack's disappearing act was the last straw.
Telling Mum that I would see her at the hospital the next morning, I asked her to give Millie a kiss for me and hung up. As I dialed Jack's mobile, I told myself to calm down. We'd never rowed before, and shouting at him down the phone like a fishwife wouldn't achieve anything. Something had obviously come up with one of his clients. A last-minute problem that he needed to sort out before we left for Thailand. He would be just as annoyed at being disturbed on his wedding day as I was. I was relieved when I heard his phone ringing. Relieved that he wasn't on the phone to someone, hoping it meant that the problem, whatever it was, had been sorted. When he didn't pick up, I stifled a cry of frustration and left a message on his voicemail.
Jack, where on earth are you? Could you phone me back, please?
I hung up and began to pace the room restlessly, wondering where he had gone. My eyes fell on the clock on the bedside table, and I saw that it was 9 o'clock. I tried to imagine why Jack hadn't answered his phone, why he hadn't been able to take my call, and wondered if one of the other partners had come to the hotel to talk to him. When another 10 minutes had gone by, I dialed his number again. This time it went straight through to his voicemail.
Jack, please phone me back, I said sharply, knowing he must have turned off his mobile after my last call. I need to know where you are.
I heaved my suitcase onto the bed, opened it, and took out the beige trousers and shirt I planned to wear for travelling the following day. Pulling them on over my camisole and knickers, I dressed quickly, put the keycard into my pocket, and left the room, taking my telephone with me. Too agitated to wait for the lift, I took the stairs down to the lobby and headed for the reception desk.
Mrs. Angel, isn't it?
The young man behind the desk smiled at me.
How can I help you?
Actually, I'm looking for my husband. Have you seen him anywhere?
Yes, he came down about an hour ago, not long after you checked in.
Do you know where he went? Did he go to the bar by any chance? He shook his head.
He went out through the front doors. I presumed he was going to fetch something from the car.
Did you see him come back in?
Now that you mention it, no, I didn't. But I was busy checking in another client at one point, so it could be that I didn't see him.
He eyed the phone in my hand.
Have you tried phoning him?
Yes, but his mobile switched off. He's probably in the bar, drowning his sorrows that he's now a married man. I smiled, trying to make light of it. I'll go and have a look. I made my way to the bar, but there was no sign of Jack. I checked the various lounges, the fitness room and the swimming pool. On the way to check the 2 restaurants, I left another message on his voicemail, my voice breaking with anxiety.
No luck?
The receptionist gave me a sympathetic look as I arrived back in the lobby on my own. I shook my head. I'm afraid I can't find him anywhere.
Have you looked if your car is still in the car park? At least you'd know whether or not he left the hotel.
I went out through the front doors and followed the path round to the car park at the back of the hotel. The car wasn't where Jack had left it, and nor was it anywhere else. Not wanting to go back through the lobby and face the receptionist again, I went in through the back door and ran up the stairs to the bedroom, praying that I would find Jack already there, that he would have arrived back while I'd been out looking for him. When I found the bedroom empty, I burst into tears of frustration. I told myself that the fact the car was missing went some way to explaining why he hadn't answered his phone, because he never answered the phone while he was driving. But if he'd had to go back to the office on urgent business, why hadn't he knocked on the bathroom door and told me? And if he hadn't wanted to disturb me in my bath, why hadn't he at least left me a note? Increasingly worried, I dialed his number and left a tearful message, saying that if I didn't hear from him within the next 10 minutes, I was going to phone the police. I knew that the police would be my last port of call, that before phoning them I would phone Adam, but I hoped that in mentioning the police, Jack would realise just how worried I was. They were the longest 10 minutes of my life. Then, just as I was about to call Adam, my phone beeped, telling me I'd received a text message. Letting out a shaky sigh of relief, I opened it, and when I saw it was from Jack, tears of relief fell from my eyes, making it impossible to read what he'd written. But it didn't matter, because I knew what it would say. I knew it would say that he'd been called away unexpectedly, that he was sorry I'd been worried, but that he hadn't been able to answer his phone because he'd been in a meeting, that he'd be back soon, and that he loved me. I reached for a tissue from the box on the desk, wiped my eyes, blew my nose, and looked at the message again. "Don't be so hysterical, it doesn't suit you. Something's come up. I'll see you in the morning." Stunned, I sat down on the bed, reading the message over and over again, convinced I'd misunderstood it in some way. I couldn't believe that Jack would have written something so cruel or been so cutting. He had never spoken to me in such a way before. He had never even raised his voice to me. I felt as if I'd been slapped in the face. And why wouldn't he be back until the following morning? Surely I deserved some explanation and, at the very least, an apology. Suddenly furious, I called him back, trembling with anger, daring him to answer his phone, and when he didn't, I had to force myself not to leave a voicemail that I would later regret. I needed to talk to someone, badly, so it was sobering to realise there was no one I could call. My parents and I didn't have the sort of relationship that would allow me to sob down the phone that Jack had left me by myself on our wedding night, and for some reason, I felt too ashamed to tell any of my friends. I would normally have confided in Kate or Emily, but at the wedding, I realised how much I'd neglected them since I met Jack, so I didn't feel able to call them either. I thought about phoning Adam to see if he knew why Jack had been called away so suddenly, but as they didn't work in the same field, I doubted he would know. And again, there was the feeling of shame that something could be more important to Jack on our wedding night than me. Stemming the tears that fell from my eyes with a tissue, I made an effort to understand. If he was with one of the other lawyers, I reasoned, locked in some delicate meeting, it was normal that he had turned his phone off after my first attempt to contact him so that he wouldn't be further disturbed. He'd probably intended to phone me back as soon as he had a chance, but the meeting must have gone on longer than expected. Maybe, during a quick break, he had listened to my messages and, angry at my tone of voice, had retaliated by sending me a sharp text message instead of phoning me. And maybe he had guessed that if he did speak to me, I'd be so overwrought that he wouldn't have been able to get back to his meeting until he'd calmed me down. It all sounded so plausible that I regretted acting as hysterically as I had. Jack had been right to be angry with me. I had already seen how his work could impinge on our relationship. God knew how many times he had been too tired or too stressed for sex, and he had already apologised for it, and had begged me to understand that the very nature of his work meant that he couldn't always be there, both mentally and physically, for me. I had been proud of the fact that we'd never rowed, but now I had fallen at the first hurdle. I wanted nothing more but to see Jack,
to tell him how sorry I was, to feel his arms around me, to hear him say that he forgave me. Reading his message again, I realized that when he said he'd see me in the morning, he probably meant the small hours. Feeling much calmer and suddenly very tired, I got undressed and climbed into bed, relishing the thought of being woken before too long by Jack making love to me. I just had time to hope that Millie was still sleeping soundly before I fell into a deep sleep. It hadn't occurred to me that Jack might be spending the night with another woman, but it was the first thought that entered my mind when I woke sometime after 8 the next morning and realized that he hadn't come back after all. Fighting down panic, I reached for my mobile, expecting to find a message from him, if only to say at what time he would be at the hotel. But there was nothing. And because there was the possibility that he'd decided to snatch a couple of hours' sleep in the office rather than disturb me, I was reluctant to phone him in case I woke him up. But I was desperate to speak to him, so I called him anyway. When I got his voicemail, I took a deep breath and left a message in as normal a tone as I could muster, asking him to let me know what time I could expect him at the hotel, and telling him that we needed to call by the hospital to see Millie on the way to the airport. Then I showered, dressed, and sat down to wait. As I waited, I realized that I didn't even know what time our flight was due to leave. I vaguely remembered Jack saying something about an afternoon flight, so I guessed that we would have to be at the airport at least a couple of hours before. When I eventually received a text message from Jack, almost an hour later, I was again bewildered by its tone. There was no apology, no mention of anything, except an order to meet him in the hotel car park at 11. By the time I struggled into the lift with our two suitcases and my hand luggage, my stomach was churning with anxiety. As I handed the room key in at the reception, I was glad that the man I had spoken to the night before had been replaced by a young woman who, I hoped, knew nothing of my missing husband. A porter helped me take the luggage out to the car park. I told him that my husband had gone to fill the car with petrol and headed for a nearby bench, ignoring his suggestion that I'd be better off waiting in the warmth of the hotel. I hadn't wanted to take a heavy coat with me to Thailand, and because I'd expected to go from the hotel to the car to the airport, barely venturing out into the open, I was only wearing a jacket, which was no match for the vicious wind that whipped across the car park. By the time Jack showed up, 25 minutes later, I was blue with cold and on the verge of tears. Stopping the car only feet away from me, he got out and walked over to where I was sitting. "Get in," he said, picking up the cases and loading them into the boot. Too cold to argue, I stumbled into the car and huddled against the door, wanting only to feel warm again. I waited for him to speak, to say something, anything, which would go some way to explaining why I felt as if I was sitting next to someone I didn't know. When the silence had gone on for too long, I summoned up the courage to look at him. The lack of emotion on his face shocked me. I had expected to see anger, stress, or irritation, but there was nothing. "What's going on, Jack?" I asked unsteadily. It was as if I hadn't spoken. "For God's sake, Jack," I cried. "What the hell is going on?" "Please don't swear," he said distastefully. I looked at him in amazement. "What do you expect? You disappear without a word, leaving me to spend our wedding night alone, and then you turn up half an hour late to fetch me, leaving me waiting in the freezing cold. Surely I have a right to be angry." "No," he said, "you don't. You have no rights at all." "Don't be ridiculous. Is there someone else, Jack? Is that what all this is about? Are you in love with somebody else? Is that where you were last night?" "Now it's you who's being ridiculous.
You're my wife, Grace. Why would I need anybody else?
Defeated, I shook my head miserably. I don't understand. Is there some problem at work? Something you can't tell me about?
I'll explain everything when we're in Thailand.
Why can't you tell me now? Please, Jack, tell me what's wrong.
In Thailand.
I wanted to tell him that I didn't particularly feel like going to Thailand with him in the mood he was in. But I took comfort in the fact that once there, I would at least have an explanation as to why our marriage had got off to such a bad start. Because his mood seemed to be related to some sort of problem at work, I couldn't help feeling apprehensive that it might be something I'd be seeing a lot more of in the future. I was so busy working out how I would adjust to being married to a man that I hadn't known existed, that it was a while before I realised we were heading straight out to the airport.
"What about Millie?" I cried. "We're meant to be going to see her."
"I'm afraid it's too late," he said. "We should have turned off miles back."
"But I told you in my message that we had to stop by the hospital."
"Well, as you didn't mention anything about it when you got into the car, I thought you changed your mind. Besides, we really don't have time."
"But our flight isn't until this afternoon."
"Leaves at 3, which means we have to check in at 12.
"But I promised her. I told Millie I'd go and see her this morning."
"When? When did you tell her that? I don't remember."
"When she was in the ambulance."
"She was unconscious, so she'll hardly remember."
"That's not the point. Anyway, I told Mum that we'd call in, and she'll have told Millie."
"Well, if you had checked with me first, I would have told you that it wouldn't be possible."
"How could I check with you when you weren't there? Jack, please turn back. We have plenty of time. The check-in may open at 12, but it won't close until much later. I won't stay long. I promise, I just want to see her."
"It's out of the question, I'm afraid."
"Why are you being like this?" I cried. "You know what Millie's like. You know she won't understand if I don't turn up."
"Then phone her and explain. Phone her and tell her you got it wrong."
Frustrated, I burst into tears.
"I didn't get it wrong," I sobbed. "We have plenty of time. You know we do."
He had never seen me cry before, and although I felt ashamed at resorting to tears, I hoped he would realise how unreasonable he was being. So when he swung the car off the road, taking an exit to a service station at the last minute, I wiped my eyes and blew my nose, thinking he was going to turn back.
"Thank you," I said, as he brought the car to a standstill.
Switching off the ignition, he turned towards me.
"Listen to me, Grace, and listen carefully. If you want to go and see Millie, you can. You can get out of the car now and take a taxi to the hospital. But I'm going on to the airport, and if you choose to go to the hospital, you won't be coming to Thailand with me. It's as simple as that."
I shook my head, making fresh tears cascade down my cheeks.
"I don't believe you," I wept. "You wouldn't make me choose between you and Millie. Not if you loved me."
"But that's exactly what I'm doing."
"How can I choose?"
I looked at him in anguish.
"I love both of you."
He gave a sigh of irritation.
"It saddens me that you're making such a song and dance about it. Surely it should be simple. Are you really going to throw away our marriage simply because I refuse to turn back to see Millie when we're already well on the way to the airport? Is that how little I mean to you?"
"No, of course not,"
I gulped, swallowing down my tears. "And don't you think I've been very generous in the past? Never complaining about the amount of time we have to spend with Millie each weekend?"
"Yes,"
I said miserably. He nodded, satisfied.
"So what's it to be, Grace? The airport or the hospital? Your husband or your sister?"
He paused a moment.
"Me or Millie?"
"You, Jack,"
I said quietly.
"You, of course."
Good. Now, where's your passport?
In my bag, I mumbled.
Can I have it?
I picked up my bag, took out my passport, and handed it to him.
Thank you,
he said, slipping it into the inside pocket of his jacket. Without another word, he put the car into gear, drove out of the service station and back onto the motorway. Despite what had happened, I couldn't really believe that he wouldn't take me to see Millie, and I wondered if what had just happened had been some kind of test, and that because I had chosen him over her, he was now going to take me to the hospital. When I saw that we were once again heading for the airport, I felt desperate. Not just because of Millie, but also because, in the 6 months since I had met Jack, I had never even glimpsed this side of his character. I had never guessed that he could be anything but the kindest, most reasonable man in the universe. All of my instincts told me to ask him to stop the car and let me out. But I was scared of what would happen if I did. In the mood he was in, there was no way of knowing if he would do as he had threatened and go on to Thailand without me. And if he did, where would that leave me? Us? Our marriage? By the time we got to the airport, I felt sick with stress. As we stood in the queue, waiting to check in, Jack suggested that I phone Mum to tell her that we'd been unable to call in at the hospital, telling me that the sooner I did, the better it would be for all concerned. Still bewildered by his attitude, I did as he asked, and when my call went straight through to Mum's voicemail, I didn't know whether to be upset or relieved. On balance, I decided it was probably just as well that I couldn't speak to Millie, and left a message explaining that, because I had made a mistake with the time of our flight, I wouldn't be able to call in after all. I asked Mum to give Millie a kiss from me, and to tell her that I would call once we got to Thailand. As I hung up, Jack smiled and took my hand in his, and, for the first time ever, I wanted to snatch it away again. When it was time for us to approach the desk, Jack was so utterly charming to the hostess, explaining we were newlyweds and that we had had a disastrous wedding day because our bridesmaid, who had Down syndrome, had fallen down the stairs and broken her leg, that we were upgraded to first class. But it didn't make me feel any better. If anything, the fact that he had used Millie's condition to gain sympathy disgusted me. The old Jack would never have done such a thing, and the thought of spending the next 2 weeks with someone who had become a virtual stranger was terrifying. Yet the alternative, telling Jack I didn't want to go to Thailand with him, was equally so. As we went through passport control, I couldn't shake the feeling that I was making the biggest mistake of my life. I felt even more confused in the departure lounge when Jack sat and read the paper with his arm draped around my shoulders, as if he didn't have a care in the world. I refused champagne when it was offered to us, hoping Jack would understand that I wasn't in the mood for a celebration. But he accepted a glass readily, seemingly unaffected by the chasm that now existed between us. I tried to tell myself that what had happened between us was nothing more than a lover's tiff, a momentary blip on the path to a long and happy marriage. But I knew it was more serious than that. Desperate to understand where we had gone wrong, I went over everything that had happened since I'd stepped out of the bathroom less than 24 hours earlier. And when I remembered the panicked messages I'd left on his phone, I began to wonder if I was the one in the wrong. But I knew I wasn't. I knew it was Jack's fault. It was just that I was so tired, I couldn't work out why. Suddenly, I couldn't wait to be on the plane, hoping that after being pampered for 14 hours, I would arrive in Thailand in a better frame of mind. Because I had also refused to eat anything in the departure lounge, I was desperately hungry by the time we boarded, as I'd been too upset to eat breakfast.
Jack was solicitous as we settled into our seats, making sure I had everything I needed, and my mood began to lift slightly. As I began to relax, I could feel my eyes closing.
"Tired?" Jack asked.
"Yes," I nodded. "And very hungry. If I fall asleep, could you wake me for dinner?"
"Of course."
I was gone before the plane had even taken off. When I eventually opened my eyes again, the cabin was in darkness and everyone seemed to be sleeping. Only Jack was awake, reading the newspaper. I looked at him in dismay. "I thought I asked you to wake me for dinner."
"I thought it better not to disturb you. But don't worry, they'll be serving breakfast in a couple of hours."
"I can't wait a couple of hours. I haven't eaten since yesterday."
"Then ask one of the hostesses to bring you something."
I stared at him, over the divide between us. In our other life, before we'd got married, he would have rung for the hostess himself. Where had the perfect gentleman I'd thought him to be gone? Had it all been a facade? Had he covered his true self with a cloak of geniality and good humour to impress me? Aware of my eyes on him, he put down his paper. "Who are you, Jack?" I asked quietly.
"Your husband," he said. "I am your husband."
Taking my hand in his, he raised it to his lips and kissed it.
"For better or for worse, in sickness and in health, till death do us part."
Letting go of my hand, he pushed the button, summoning the hostess. She came immediately.
"Could you bring my wife something to eat, please? She missed dinner, I'm afraid."
"Certainly, sir," she smiled.
"There," said Jack, once she'd left. "Happy?"
He turned back towards his newspaper, and I was glad he couldn't see the tears of pathetic gratitude that had pricked in my eyes. When my food was brought, I ate it quickly and, not particularly wanting to talk to Jack, I slept until we began our descent into Bangkok. Jack had insisted on making all the arrangements for our honeymoon because he wanted it to be a surprise for me. He had already been to Thailand several times and knew the best places to stay, so even though I had hinted heavily about Koh Samui, I had little idea of where we were actually going. I couldn't help feeling disappointed when, rather than head for domestic departures, Jack led me towards the taxi rank. Soon we were on our way into the centre of Bangkok, and I couldn't help feeling excited by the hustle and bustle of the city, although a little appalled at the noise. When the taxi slowed down in front of a hotel called the Golden Temple, my spirits lifted even more, as it was one of the most beautiful hotels I'd ever seen. Instead of coming to a stop, the taxi continued on its way until we arrived in front of a good but less luxurious hotel 300 metres further down the road. The lobby was better than its facade, but when we arrived in our room and found the bathroom to be so small that Jack would have trouble using the shower, I fully expected him to turn round and leave at once.
"Perfect," he said, taking off his jacket and hanging it in the wardrobe. "This will do nicely."
"Jack, you can't be serious." I looked around the room. "Surely we can do better than this."
"It's time to wake up, Grace."
He looked so solemn. I wondered why it hadn't occurred to me that he might have lost his job. And the more I thought about it, the more I realised that I'd found the perfect explanation for his sudden change of character. If he had been told sometime on Friday evening, I reasoned, my mind darting back and forth as I tried to work it out, he'd probably gone back to the office on Saturday while I was having my bath to try to sort things out with the other partners before we left on honeymoon. Of course he wouldn't have wanted to tell me during our wedding. Of course my visit to Millie must have seemed paltry compared to what he was going through. No wonder he'd wanted to wait until we were in Thailand to tell me what had happened, and as he had obviously changed our hotel reservation for something cheaper, I prepared myself to hear that he hadn't managed to negotiate his job back.
What's happened? I asked.
The dream is over, I'm afraid.
It doesn't matter, I said reassuringly, telling myself that it could be the best thing to happen to us. We'll manage.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm sure you'll be able to find another job easily. Or you could even set up on your own if you wanted. And if things are really tight, I could always go back to work. I wouldn't be able to have my old job back, but I'm sure they'd take me on in some capacity or other.
He gave me an amused look. I haven't lost my job, Grace.
I stared at him. Then what is all this about?
He shook his head sorrowfully. You should have chosen Millie. You really should have.
I felt a prickle of fear run down my spine. What's going on? I asked, trying to keep my voice calm. Why are you being like this?
Do you realise what you've done? Do you realise that you've sold your soul to me? And Millie's, for that matter. He paused. Especially Millie's.
Stop it, I said sharply. Stop playing games with me.
It's not a game.
The calmness of his voice sent panic shooting through me. I felt my eyes dart around the room, subconsciously looking for a way out.
It's too late, he said, noticing. Far too late.
I don't understand, I said, choking back a sob. What is it that you want?
Exactly what I've got. You and Millie.
You haven't got Millie, and you certainly haven't got me. Snatching up my handbag, I looked angrily at him. I'm going back to London.
He let me get as far as the door. Grace?
I took my time turning round, because I wasn't sure how I was going to react when he told me what I knew he was going to tell me. That it had all been some kind of stupid joke. Neither did I want him to see how relieved I was, because I couldn't bear to think what would have happened if he had let me step over the threshold.
What? I asked coolly.
He put his hand in his pocket and drew out my passport.
Aren't you forgetting something?
Holding it between his finger and thumb, he dangled it in front of me.
You can't go to England without it, you know.
In fact, you can't go anywhere without it. I held out my hand. Give it to me, please.
No.
Give me my passport, Jack. I mean it.
Even if I were to give it to you, how would you get to the airport without money?
I have money, I said haughtily, glad that I'd bought some Bart before we'd left. I also have a credit card.
No, he said, shaking his head regretfully. You don't. Not anymore.
Unzipping my handbag quickly, I saw that my purse was missing, as was my mobile phone. Where's my purse? And my phone? What have you done with them? I lunged for his travel bag and scrabbled through it, looking for them.
You won't find them in there, he said, amused. You're wasting your time.
Do you really think you can keep me a prisoner here? That I won't be able to get away if I want to?
That, he said solemnly, is where Millie comes in.
I felt myself go cold.
What do you mean? Put it this way. What do you think will happen to her if I stop paying her school fees? An asylum, perhaps?
I'll pay her fees. I have enough money from the sale of my house.
You paid that money over to me, remember? To buy furniture for our new house, which I did. As for what was left over, well, it's mine now. You don't have any money, Grace. None at all.
Then I'll go back to work. And I'll sue you for the rest of my money, I added savagely.
No, you won't. For a start, you won't be going back to work.
You can't stop me.
Of course I can.
How? This is the 21st century, Jack. If all of this is really happening, If it isn't some kind of sick joke. Do you really think I'm going to stay married to you?
Yes, because you'll have no choice. Why don't you sit down and I'll tell you why?
I'm not interested. Just give me my passport and enough money to get back to England and we'll put this down to some terrible mistake. You can stay here if you like and when we get back, we can tell everybody that we realised it wasn't meant to be and have decided to separate.
That's very generous of you. He took a moment to consider it, and I found I was holding my breath. The only trouble is, I don't make mistakes. I never have, and I never will.
Please, Jack, I said desperately. Please, let me go.
I'll tell you what I'll do. If you sit down, I'll explain everything to you, just as I said I would. And after, when you've heard what I've got to say, if you still want to leave, I'll let you.
Do you promise?
You have my word.
I quickly weighed up my options, and when I realised that I didn't have any, I sat down on the edge of the bed, as far away from him as I could.
Go on, then.
He nodded.
But before I begin, just so you understand how serious I am, I'm going to let you into a secret.
I looked at him warily.
What?
He leant towards me, a small smile playing at the corner of his mouth.
There is no housekeeper, he whispered.
Present. When we arrive back at the house after lunch with Diane and Esther, I go up to my room, as I always do. I hear the click of the key turning in the lock, and a few minutes later, the whir of the shutters coming down. A further precaution against the unlikelihood that I should find a way down through the locked door and down the stairs into the hall. My ears, finely attuned to the slightest sounds, because there is nothing else, no music, no television to stimulate them, pick up the whir of the black gates opening and, soon after, the sound of the car scrunching down the gravel drive. I don't feel as anxious by his departure as I normally do, because today I have eaten. Once, he didn't come back for 3 days, by which time I was ready to eat the bathroom soap. I look around the room that has been my home for the last 6 months. There isn't much, just a bed, a barred window and another door. It leads to a small bathroom, my only portal to a different world, where a shower, basin and toilet stand, a tiny cake of soap and towel, its only ornaments. Although I know every inch of these two rooms, my eyes continually search them because there is always the thought that I might have missed something that would make my life more bearable. A nail that I could use to etch my distress on the edge of the bed, or to at least leave some trace of me should I suddenly disappear. But there is nothing. Anyway, it isn't death that Jack has in mind for me. What he has planned is more subtle than that, and, as always when I think about what is coming, I pray frantically that he'll be killed in a car accident on the way home from work. If not tonight, then before the end of June, when Millie will come to live with us. Because after that, it will be too late. There are no books, no paper or pen that I could use to distract myself. I spend my days suspended in time, a passive lump of humanity. At least, that is what Jack sees. In reality, I am biding my time, waiting for a tiny window of opportunity to open, as it surely will. Because if I don't believe that it will, how could I carry on? How could I continue with the charade my life has become? I almost thought my chance had come today, which, in retrospect, was pretty stupid of me. How could I have really thought that Jack would let me attend a lunch on my own, where I could have used the opportunity to escape from him? It was simply that he had never gone as far as taking me all the way before, but had been content to toy with my delusions.
Once, the time I pretended to Diane that I'd forgotten I was supposed to be meeting her for lunch, he had driven me halfway to the restaurant before turning back, laughing at the way my face had crumpled in desperate disappointment when I realised that my chance to escape had gone. I often think about killing him, but I can't. For a start, I don't have the means. I have no access to medicine, knives, or any other instrument of destruction, because he has me covered in every way. If I ask for an aspirin for a headache, and he deigns to bring me one, he waits until I have swallowed it so that I can't hide it somewhere, and little by little, headache after headache, stockpile enough to poison him with. Any meal he brings me is served on a plastic plate and accompanied by plastic cutlery and a plastic glass. When I prepare food for a dinner party, he is present at all times and watches carefully as I store the knives back in their boxes in case I should decide to hide one about my person and use it on him at an opportune moment. Or he cuts and slices what I need. Anyway, what would be the point of killing him? If I were sent to prison or awaiting trial, what would become of Millie? I haven't always been so passive, though. Before I fully understood the hopelessness of my situation, I was ingenious in my attempts to get away from him. But in the end, it just wasn't worth it. The price I paid each time became too high. I get up from where I've been sitting on the bed and look through the window at the garden below. The bars are set so close together it would be futile to break the glass in the hope of squeezing through them, and my chances of finding a convenient object with which to file through them are nil. Even if I were to find something, by some miracle, on one of the rare occasions that I'm allowed out of the house, I wouldn't be able to pick it up because Jack is always with me. He is my keeper, my guardian, my jailer. I am not allowed to go anywhere without him by my side, not even to the toilet in a restaurant. Jack thinks that if he were to let me out of his sight for even 2 seconds, I would use the opportunity to tell someone of my plight, to ask for help, to flee. But I wouldn't. Not anymore. Not unless I was 100% sure that I would be believed, because I have Millie to think about. She is the reason I don't call out for help in the street or in a restaurant. That, and the fact that Jack is far more credible than I am. I tried it once and was thought of as a madwoman, while Jack got sympathy for having to put up with my incoherent ravings. There is no clock in my bedroom, and I have no watch, but I've become quite adept at judging the time. It's easier in winter time when night falls early, but in the summer, I have no real idea of the exact time Jack comes back from work. It could be anything from 7 to 10, for all I know. Bizarre as it seems, I'm always comforted by the sound of his return. Since the time he didn't come back for 3 days, I have a fear of starving to death. He did it to teach me a lesson. If I've learned anything about Jack, it is that everything he does and everything he says is calculated down to the last full stop. He prides himself on uttering only the truth, and enjoys that I am the only one who understands the meaning behind his words. The comment he made at our dinner party, when he said that Millie coming to live with us would add another dimension to our lives, is just one example of his double entendres. His other comment, that it was the knowledge I would do anything for Millie, which made him realise I was the woman he'd been looking for all his life, another. Tonight, he comes home, by my estimation, at about 8 o'clock. I hear the front door opening, then closing behind him, his footsteps in the hall, the sound of his keys being thrown down on the hall table. I imagine him taking his phone from his pocket and, seconds later, I hear the rattle as he puts it down next to the keys. There is a pause, then the sound of the door to the cloakroom opening as he hangs up his jacket. I know enough about him to know he'll go straight to the kitchen and pour himself a whiskey, but I only know this because my room lies above the kitchen, and I've learnt to distinguish the different sounds as his evening begins. Sure enough, a minute or so later, after he's looked through the post, maybe, I hear him walk into the kitchen, open the cupboard door, take a glass out, close the cupboard door, walk across to the freezer, open the door, open the drawer, remove the ice cube tray, crack it to release the ice cubes, drop two into the glass, one after the other. I hear him turn on the tap, refill the tray, put it back in the drawer, close the drawer, close the door, pick up the bottle of whiskey from where it stands on the side, unscrew the cap, pour a shot of whiskey into his glass, put the cap back on, replace the bottle on the side, pick up the glass, swirl the whiskey around with the ice. I don't actually hear the sound of him taking his first sip, but I imagine he does, because a few seconds always pass before I hear him walking back across the kitchen floor, out into the hall and into his study. It could be that he'll bring me up some food during the evening, but after all I ate at lunchtime, I'm not worried if he doesn't. There is no regularity to the meals he brings me. I may get one in the morning, or one in the evening, or none at all. If he brings me breakfast, there may be cereals and a glass of juice, or a piece of fruit and water. In the evenings, it may be a three-course meal and a glass of wine, or a sandwich and some milk. Jack knows there is nothing more comforting than routine, so he denies me any semblance of it. Although he doesn't know it, he is doing me a favour. Without routine, there is no risk of me becoming institutionalised and unable to think for myself. And I must think for myself. It's horrendous to be dependent on somebody for the mere basics of life. Although, thanks to the tap in my tiny bathroom, I'll never die of thirst. I could die of boredom, though, because there's nothing to relieve the empty days that stretch before me into infinity. The dinner parties I used to dread so much are now a welcome diversion. I even enjoy the challenge of Jack's increasingly exacting demands about what we will serve our guests to eat, because when I triumph, as I did last Saturday, the taste of success makes my existence bearable. Such is my life. Maybe half an hour or so after he arrived home, I hear his footsteps on the stairs, then on the landing. The key turns in the lock. The door opens, and he stands in the doorway. My handsome, psychopathic husband. I look hopefully at his hands, but he isn't carrying a tray. We've received an email from Millie's school saying they'd like to speak to us. He watches me for a moment. What could they possibly want to talk to us about, I wonder? I feel myself go cold. I have no idea, I say, glad he can't see the way my heart has started beating faster. Well, we'll just have to go and find out, won't we? Janice apparently told Mrs. Goodrich that we plan to visit again this Sunday, and she suggested we go down a little earlier so we can have a chat. He pauses. I do hope everything is all right. I'm sure it is, I say with more calm than I feel. It had better be. He leaves, locking the door behind him. Although I'm glad that Mrs. Goodrich sent the email, because it means I'll get to see Millie again, uneasiness settles in. We've never been summoned to the school before. Millie knows she mustn't say a word, but sometimes I wonder if she really understands. She has no idea of how much is at stake, because how could I ever tell her? The need to find a solution to the nightmare we are caught up in, the nightmare that I let us be caught up in, presses down on me, and I force myself to take deep breaths, not to panic. I have almost 4 months, I remind myself. 4 months to find that window of opportunity and to somehow get me and Millie through it by myself, because there is no one to help us. The only people who might have been able to, because some primal maternal or paternal instinct may have told them I was in trouble, are now on the other side of the world, encouraged to move there even more rapidly than they'd intended, by Jack. He is so clever. So very clever. Everything I have ever told him, he has used against me. I wish I'd never told him of my parents' horror when Millie was born, or how they were counting the days until I fulfilled my promise of having Millie to live with me, so that they could finally move to New Zealand. It allowed him to play on their dread that I would somehow renege on the promise I'd made, and that they would end up having to look after Millie themselves. The weekend he asked me to take him to see my parents, it wasn't to ask my father for my hand in marriage, but rather to tell him that I'd been talking about Millie going to New Zealand with them, as I wanted to get married and start a family of my own. When my father had almost died of shock, Jack suggested it might be an idea for them to emigrate sooner rather than later, effectively erasing the only people who might have been able to help me. I sit down on the bed, wondering how I'm going to get through the rest of the evening, and then the night. Sleep won't come, not when there's the meeting with Mrs. Goodrich hanging over me. Looking at it objectively, it would be the perfect opportunity to blurt out the truth. That Jack is keeping me prisoner, that he means untold harm to Millie, and beg her to help me to call the police. But I've already been there. I've already done that. And I know to my cost that at this very minute, Jack will be planning my downfall should I so much as breathe differently during the meeting. Not only will I end up humiliated and more desperate than I already am, Jack will make sure to exact his revenge. I hold my hands out in front of me, and the shaking that I can't control tells me what I've only just begun to realise, but what Jack has known all along. That fear is the best deterrent of all. Past. What do you mean? I asked, as I sat on the edge of the bed in our hotel room, wondering why, when he had given me the choice of going to the hospital to see Millie or carrying on to Thailand with him, I had believed, despite everything that had happened since our wedding, that he was still a good man. Exactly what I said. There is no housekeeper. I sighed, too tired for his rigmaroles. What is it you want to tell me? A story. A story about a young boy. Would you like to hear it? If it means that you'll let me leave, yes, I'd love to hear it. Good. He drew up the one chair in the room and sat down in front of me. There was once a young boy who lived in a country far, far away from here, with his mother and father. When he was very young, the boy feared the strong and powerful father and loved the mother. But when he saw that the mother was weak and useless and unable to protect him from the father, the boy began to despise her and rejoiced in the look of terror in her eyes as the father dragged her down to the cellar to be locked in with the rats. The knowledge that the father could instill such terror into another human being turned the boy's fear of him into admiration, and he began to emulate him. Soon, the sound of his mother's screams coming up through the floorboards became music to his ears, and the smell of her fear the richest perfume. Such was the effect it had on him that he began to crave it, so that when the father left him in charge, the boy would take the mother down to the cellar, her pleas for mercy as she begged him not to leave her there, only serving to excite him. And afterwards, as he drank in the sound of her fear and breathed in the smell of it, he wished he could keep her there for eternity. One night, when the boy was about 13 years old, the mother managed to escape from the basement while the father was working outside in the allotment.
But the boy knew that if she left, he would never hear the sound of her fear again. So he hit her to stop her from leaving. And when she screamed, he hit her again and again. And the more she screamed, the more he hit her. And he found he couldn't stop, even when she fell to the ground. And as he looked down at her smashed and bloodied face, he thought she had never looked so beautiful. The father, brought by the mother's screams, arrived and pulled the boy off her. But it was too late, because she was already dead. The father was angry and hit the boy, and the boy hit him back. When the police came, the boy told them that his father had killed the mother and that he had tried to protect her. So the father went to prison, and the boy was glad. As the boy grew older, he began to crave someone of his own, someone in whom he could instill fear whenever he wanted, however he wanted, someone he could keep hidden away, someone nobody would ever miss. He knew it wouldn't be easy to find such a person, but he was convinced that if he looked hard enough, he eventually would. And while he looked, he searched for a way to satisfy his cravings. So, do you know what he did? I shook my head numbly. He became a lawyer, specializing in cases of domestic violence. And then, do you know what he did? He leant forward and put his mouth close to my ear. He married you, Grace. I found I could hardly breathe. All the time he'd been speaking, I hadn't wanted to believe he was the boy in the story. But now, a terrible shaking took hold of me. As the room swam before my eyes, he sat back and stretched his legs out in front of him, a satisfied look on his face. Now, tell me, did you enjoy that story? No, I said, my voice trembling. But I listened to it. So, can I go now? I made to stand up, but he pushed me back down. I'm afraid not. Tears of fright spilled from my eyes. You promised.
Did I?
Please. Please let me go. I won't tell anyone what you just told me. I promise.
Of course you would.
I shook my head. No, no. No, I wouldn't. He was silent for a moment, as if he was considering what I'd said.
The thing is, Grace, I can't let you go, because I need